This 1/2 hour, 1/2 credit CLE course is based on the January 2019 criminal law update pamphlet, which is posted on the New York Appellate Digest website, and which is a compilation of the summaries of New York State appellate decisions in the area of criminal law that were released in the one-month period of January 2019. The page references in the CLE are to the pamphlet. First case we're going to look at is People versus Ortiz on pages 6 and 7. It deals with essentially the main point is the need for expert evidence for cell site location evidence. But there were many other errors that the court dealt with in this case. This is a First Department case reversing defendant's conviction because it determined the cumulative effect of all the errors deprived defendant of a fair trial. Those errors included, number one, the witness from the cell phone company was not an engineer and therefore could not provide competent expert opinion about where the defendant's cell phone was in relation to the cell phone tower which picked up the signal. Two, a police officer should not have been allowed to testify that the victim had twice identified the defendant by name. Three, the charge to the jury improperly marshaled the identification evidence in a light favorable to the prosecution. Four, the court should have given the missing witness jury instruction for two lead detectives who had interviewed the victim and a witness. And five, the judge should not have referenced the defendant's failure to testify. Concerning the cell tower and the identification evidence, the court said, testimony on how cell phone towers operate must be offered by an expert witness, because an analysis of the possible ranges of cell phone towers and how they operate is beyond a juror's day-to-day experience and knowledge. Here the witness was not an engineer and was not qualified to reach any conclusions about why defendant's cell phone hit the Starling Avenue tower, that is, whether it was because the tower was closest or the strongest. On the identification issue, the court wrote, the trial court permitted a police officer to testify twice over defense objection that the victim had identified her attacker as male Hispanic bald by the name of Jose Ortiz. This was error. Testimony by one witness, here the police officer, to a previous identification of the defendant by another witness, here the victim, is inadmissible. Next case is in the area of guilty pleas, People versus Keller on page 7. The Second Department, vacating defendant's guilty plea, held 1, the plea was not voluntary because defendant was given the wrong information about the possible maximum sentence if he went to trial, and 2, the error is an exception to the preservation requirement for appeal because the defendant could not have known of the error at the time of the plea. The court wrote, the defendant's plea was not made knowingly, voluntarily, and intelligently. He was not presented with the legitimate alternatives about the maximum sentence he faced if he chose to reject the people's plea and then was convicted at trial. He was told by his defense attorney that the maximum aggregate sentence was 3 to 5 years. The actual maximum aggregate sentence was 2 to 4 years, and the bargained for sentence was 1.5 to 3 years. In this case, the threat of a higher sentence rendered the defendant's plea involuntary. Moving on to the case People versus Demkevich on pages 8 and 9, another guilty plea case. The Third Department vacated defendant's guilty plea in the interest of justice, determining defendant was not adequately informed of the rights he was giving up by pleading guilty. The court said, During the abbreviated plea colloquy, County Court briefly advised defendant that if he were to plead guilty, he would be giving up his right to trial, the right to testify at the trial, to call witnesses, and to cross-examine the people's witnesses. County Court did not advise defendant that he had a right to a jury trial, or that he would be waiving the privilege against self-incrimination. The court failed to obtain any assurance that defendant had discussed with counsel the trial-related rights that are automatically forfeited by pleading guilty, or the constitutional implications of a guilty plea. Moving on to the category of indictments, People versus Madsen on page 11. The Third Department held that 26 of the 37 sexual offense counts on which defendant was convicted at trial must be reversed because they were rendered duplicitous by the trial testimony. The court said, an indictment count is duplicitous when it charges more than one crime that is completed by a discrete act in the same count. Even if a count is valid on its face, it is nonetheless duplicitous where the evidence presented to the grand jury or at trial makes plain that multiple criminal acts occurred during the relevant time period, rendering it nearly impossible to determine the particular act upon which the jury reached its verdict. When the trial testimony provides evidence of repeated acts that cannot be individually related to specific counts in the indictment, the prohibition against duplicitousness has been violated. And again, 26 of the 37 sexual offense counts were vacated in that case. Next category is jury instructions. It's People versus Aturua on page 12. First Department, reversing defendant's felony murder and criminal possession of a weapon convictions, held that the jury should have been instructed on the definition of the word deprive with respect to the larceny aspect of the underlying robbery. The court said, in connection with the larceny element of attempted robbery, the offense underlying the felony murder charge, the court, upon defense counsel's request, should have instructed the jury on the definition of deprive. The failure to so charge the jury constitutes reversible error, since such omission could have misled the jury into thinking that any withholding, permanent or temporary, constituted larceny. The concepts of deprive and appropriate are essential to a definition of larcenous intent, as they connote a purpose to exert permanent or virtually permanent use of the property. It's the function of the jury to determine whether defendant intended to rob the victim and permanently keep the property taken from him. By failing to give the requested charge, the court usurped the function of the jury. Next case, People versus Alexander. It's on page 13. This is a jury selection case, a Batson case. The Second Department, reversing defendant's conviction, determined the trial court didn't handle the Batson challenge to the prosecutor's striking an African-American juror correctly. When asked about her reasons, the prosecutor said the potential juror was too young to sit on a murder trial. Upon further questioning, the potential juror had difficulty understanding and answering questions. But the court never ruled whether the prosecutor's initial reason for excluding the potential juror, his youth, was a credible race-neutral explanation. The court said, the Supreme Court failed in its duty to determine whether the prosecutor's race-neutral explanations were credible. When ruling on a Batson challenge, the trial court should consider only the reasons initially given to support the challenge strike, not any additional reasons offered after the fact. So here the court was required to make a ruling on the prosecutor's initial reason, which was that the juror was too young to sit on a murder trial. The next case is People versus Watson on page 14. It's another jury selection case, and it brings up the prerequisites or the requirements or the criteria for a reconstruction hearing when a matter is sent back by the appellate court. The first department, in a full-fledged opinion, over two separate dissenting opinions, reversing the defendant's convictions and dismissing the indictment, held the Batson reconstruction hearing, which was held after the matter was sent back to the trial court because the record on appeal was not sufficient. The hearing did not demonstrate that the prosecution's peremptory challenges to the African-American male veneer persons were justified by non-discriminatory reasons. The Batson reconstruction hearing was itself deficient because it was held with a different prosecutor and the original prosecutor's notes were not provided, nor did the original prosecutor testify. The court said, no testimony or notes were offered at this Batson reconstruction hearing. The ADA who conducted the voir dire didn't appear. His notes were never disclosed. The ADA at the reconstruction hearing could only speculate as to the motives of his colleague. This procedure was insufficient to satisfy the requirements of Batson. Next case is in the category of Miranda. It's People versus Steffens on pages 15 and 16. The second department reversed defendant's bribery and falsely reporting an incident convictions and ordered a new trial. The defendant was accused of assault by her husband. The police called her to the station where she was interviewed. After she was told she would be placed under arrest, she allegedly offered sex and money to the interviewing officer, an officer Persaud, to make the charges go away. The officer wore a wire to record further conversations about the bribery. After defendant was arraigned and represented by counsel, defendant was again interviewed in the back of a police car by Sergeant Klein and her partner concerning the alleged bribery. That conversation was also recorded. Statements made during custodial interrogation that were not preceded by Miranda warnings and statements made to police officers in the absence of counsel should not have been admitted, and defense counsel was ineffective for failing to object. The court said, Officer Persaud should have known that in telling the defendant that she needed to come to the precinct station house in connection with his investigation into the allegations her husband had made against her, allegations about which she had already been told she would be arrested, placing her in an interview room and then confronting her with the allegations and the evidence against her, including the existence of the order of protection, he was reasonably likely to elicit from the defendant an incriminating response. The defendant's alleged bribery of Officer Persaud and her allegedly false reporting of his sexual misconduct during that same encounter were so inextricably interwoven in terms of both their temporal proximity and factual interrelationship as to render unavoidable the conclusion that any interrogation concerning the allegedly false report would inevitably elicit incriminating responses regarding the matter in which there had been an entry of counsel. That was the charge by her husband, the assault charge. Furthermore, the police were aware that the defendant was actually represented by an attorney and the interrogation actually entailed an infringement of her constitutional right to counsel by impermissible questioning on the represented crimes. Moving on to the attorney, the defense counsel's incompetence. The defendant demonstrated the absence of a reasonable and legitimate strategy under the circumstances for defense counsel's stipulation to admission of a recording of the entire interview between the defendant and Sergeant Klein and her partner, and his failure to object to Sergeant Klein's testimony recounting the same interview, or Officer Persaud's testimony in which he recounted numerous statements made by the defendant of which the people failed to provide notice required by CPL 71030. At this point, I'll insert the verification code for this half-hour, half-credit CLE. The verification code is BATSON, B-A-T-S-O-N. Again, the verification code for this half-hour CLE, based on the January 2019 Criminal Law Update pamphlet, is BATSON. The next category is robbery. The case is People v. Allende on page 17. The First Department reversed defendant's robbery first conviction because although a witness saw a firearm, the victim did not. The court said, the evidence didn't establish the element of display of what appeared to be a firearm. The robbery was accomplished by assaulting the victim and taking his wallet. Although an eyewitness saw the display of what appeared to be a firearm, there was no evidence that the victim ever saw it. Next category is searches and street stops. The case is People v. DeSasso on pages 18 and 19. The Second Department, reversing defendant's possession of a weapon conviction and dismissing the indictment, held that the police officer did not have probable cause to search the van where the weapon was found. The defendant was sitting in the passenger seat smoking a cigar when the officer approached and removed him from the van, apparently because the officer thought defendant was smoking marijuana. At the time the officer searched the van, he knew defendant was smoking a cigar. Although the defendant was sitting in the passenger seat, there was no evidence to contradict his claim that the van was his work vehicle, thereby giving him standing. Supreme Court had found that he did not have standing. The court wrote, absent probable cause, it is unlawful for a police officer to invade the interior of a stopped vehicle once the suspects have been removed and patted down without incident, as any immediate threat to the officer's safety has consequently been eliminated. Contrary to the people's contention, under the circumstances here, where the defendant already had been removed from the minivan and no one else was in the minivan, the police lacked probable cause to conduct a warrantless search by opening the sliding door of the minivan, and the weapon found as a result of the unlawful search should have been suppressed. Next category is sentencing. People v. Andre on page 19. The Second Department held the sentencing court should not have imposed an enhanced sentence. Here, the court changed the agreement to impose concurrent sentences to consecutive sentences because the defendant didn't appear at sentencing. The court had not imposed his appearance as a condition for the pleas and the sentencing commitments. The Second Department wrote, we exercise our interest of justice jurisdiction to vacate the sentences. Since the record does not establish that the Supreme Court imposed as a condition on the pleas and sentencing commitments that the defendant return on the scheduled sentencing date, the court should not have imposed enhanced sentences based on the defendant's violation of this purported condition. To the extent that the court also based its imposition of enhanced sentences on the defendant, having violated certain other purported conditions, it likewise erred, since it had not imposed these conditions on the pleas and the sentencing commitments. Still in the sentencing category, People v. Hakes on page 21. The Third Department, reversing county court, held the people did not make a sufficient showing that the defendant willfully failed to pay for the alcohol monitoring device, the SCRAM bracelet. Wearing the bracelet, which cost $11 per day, was a requirement of the defendant's probation. County court was obligated to consider punishment other than imprisonment because the evidence supported defendant's inability to pay. The court said, the record lacks a basis to substantiate a finding that defendant willfully refused to make the required payments. The hearing testimony establishes that defendant made sufficient bona fide efforts to acquire the fiscal resources to pay the costs associated with SCRAM monitoring, and he could not do so as a result of his indigence, which resulted at least in part from serious injuries. County court was therefore required to consider alternate measures of punishment other than imprisonment, and it erred in failing to do so. Still in the sentencing category, in People v. Young, the Second Department noted that defendant should not have been sentenced as a second felony offender because the instant conviction was for a Class A felony. The court said the Supreme Court was not authorized to adjudicate the defendant a second violent felony offender because the instant conviction was for a Class A felony rather than a Class B, C, D, or E felony. And then it referenced two statutes, Penal Law Section 70.02 Subdivision 1 and Penal Law Section 70.04 Subdivision 1A. Still in the sentencing category, People v. Mitchell on page 23, the First Department exercised its power to modify an unduly harsh or severe sentence that was still within the permissible range. Defendant, who was homeless, attempted to buy toothpaste with a counterfeit $20 bill. The sentence was reduced from 4 to 8 years to 3 to 6 years. The court said, the appellate division has broad plenary power to modify a sentence that is unduly harsh or severe under the circumstances, even though the sentence may be within the permissible statutory range. A trial court need not abuse its discretion for the appellate division to substitute its own discretion. We may reduce a sentence in the interest of justice, taking into account factors such as defendant's age, physical and mental health, and remorse. The immediate object of defendant's crime was to purchase basic human necessities, including food and toothpaste. In consideration of the fact that he was 53 years old, unemployed, homeless man, with long-standing medical and substance abuse issues, a reduction of his sentence is appropriate. Defendant's extensive criminal history does not preclude a determination that his sentence is excessive. Moving on to the Sex Offender Registration Act, SORA category, the Barney case on page 24. The Second Department determined the evidence that defendant waived his presence at the SORA risk assessment hearing was insufficient. A new hearing was ordered. The court said, a sex offender facing risk level classification under SORA has a due process right to be present at the SORA hearing. To establish whether a defendant, by failing to appear at a SORA hearing, has waived the right to be present, evidence must be shown that the defendant was advised of the hearing date, of the right to be present at the hearing, and that the hearing would be conducted in his or her absence. Reliable hearsay evidence, such as an affidavit, is admissible to establish waiver. Here, the sole evidence that the defendant waived the right to be present was the statement by the court that it was informed, off the record, by the New York City Police Department Sex Offender Monitoring Unit that the defendant resided at an address in Manhattan and that notice of the hearing was sent to that address and was not returned as undeliverable. There was no evidence, hearsay or otherwise, that the defendant expressed a desire to forego his presence at the hearing. The fact that defense counsel had no evidence to indicate that the defendant did not receive the notice of the hearing was not sufficient to indicate a waiver. Next category is terrorism. It's People versus Kaplan on pages 25 and 26. The Third Department, reversing defendant's terrorism conviction after trial, held that there was legally insufficient evidence defendant intended to influence the policy or actions of a governmental body, here the Warren County Sheriff's Office. When defendant was told at the sheriff's office that his certificate of disposition was insufficient and defendant's property could not be returned to him, he allegedly said he would come back and shoot the place down. He was convicted of making a terroristic threat and sentenced to 5 years in prison. The court said, the record contains no evidence of a necessary element of the crime, that defendant intended to influence a policy of a governmental unit by intimidation or coercion, or that he intended to affect the conduct of a unit of government by murder, assassination, or kidnapping. The sheriff's evidence custodian testified that as defendant left the lobby of the sheriff's building, he was mumbling to himself, and she heard the word shoot. She then asked defendant what he had said, and he replied by stating, come back and shoot the place down. Defendant made no statement relating his threat to any policy of the sheriff's office or demanding that the sheriff's office take any specific action. Moving to the category of witness intimidation, People v. Walton. It's the last case on page 28. The Second Department held the evidence presented at the Sirach hearing was sufficient to warrant the conclusion that a witness, defendant's cousin, refused to testify because of the actions of the defendant. Therefore, statements made by the defendant's cousin were properly admitted at trial. The court said, the people presented phone records evidencing the dates and the content of certain calls made by the cousin to other individuals while the cousin was incarcerated at Rikers Island, and calls by the defendant to other individuals believed to be family members. The people contended these calls demonstrated that the defendant and other family members secured the cousin's agreement not to testify against the defendant. The people also represented to the Supreme Court that they planned to offer the testimony of an inmate who knew the defendant and his family, who claimed, among other things, that the defendant had told him that the defendant had put the wolves out on the cousin to keep him from testifying, and that the defendant was confident that he would beat the charges as a result. According to the people, the inmate subsequently refused to testify at the hearing out of fear. An assistant district attorney testified at the hearing as to the substance of her interview with the inmate, which had taken place the day before. The people demonstrated by clear and convincing evidence that the defendant, by violence, threats, or chicanery, caused the witness's unavailability. Misconduct is not limited to threats or intimidation. It can also include situations where, as here, the people established by clear and convincing evidence that the defendant used his close personal relationship with his cousin and threats to pressure him not to testify. So that concludes this CLE that is based on the January 2019 Criminal Law Update Pamphlet.